This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. While it appears the UAW will ratify the GM contract, we hear from one plant that voted against the deal.
They forgot about us. They got something that benefited, that was a benefit to them, but not to us, though.
We discussed possible new ordinances to restrict light pollution from blotting out the night sky.
We should be able to see tens of thousands of stars.
A report on so-called energy freedom bills in Lansing.
The idea behind it is to really add additional solar resources to the grid.
And we'll talk about the ban on baiting deer and chronic wasting disease.
Once an area has it, it's highly likely that it will not be eradicated from an endemic area, but you can prevent it.
Plus, we have a Cheers cocktail for you. First, here's a news update. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Later in the program, we'll learn about the so-called energy freedom bills working their way through the Michigan legislature. Is the state ready for microgrids and community solar?
These were kind of new concepts, not just here in Michigan, but across the country. The idea behind it is to really add additional solar resources to the grid.
Plus, one of the big issues this deer hunting season is about the ban on baiting and feeding deer. Some say the ban will hurt hunters. The experts say the ban will help slow the spread of chronic wasting disease. That's all coming up later in the hour. But first, the longest General Motors strike since 1970 appears to be near its end. UAW members at the company's largest plants have voted to ratify the contract. Workers went out on strike to put an end to concessions that divided the union, an expanded use of temporary workers, a tiered wage structure. Now, on day 40 of the strike, Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer brings us a deeper look at one plant. General Motors Components Holdings is located in Wyoming, near Grand Rapids. There, all production workers made a lower tier wage, and many people feel let down by how this strike has played out.
On her first day of strike duty, Cindy Holmes looked up at a clear blue sky and saw a bald eagle soaring over the picket line.
It was flying really low. It was just circling around, soaring. It was just doing its thing. You know what I mean? Like, it was like, oh, I'm cool.
It seemed like a promising sign on the first day of what would become a historic strike. That first week, lots of workers were excited. It was chaotic and new. By day 8, reality was setting in.
Now, this is the first strike for all of us, really.
Willie Holmes is the president of UAW Local 167, which represents the workers at the Wyoming plant.
And a lot of our workers are brand new, so they really don't know. And they are panicked and they are scared.
On day 12, workers missed their first paycheck. Willie Holmes walks with me out to the picket line, past a credit union and a Mexican bakery. The plant sits on a corner with several entrances. Workers picket all the entrances. Outside, a large sign says General Motors Components Holdings. Those last two words make a huge difference.
Our plant is not a traditional GM plant. We're Components Holding. We're a subsidiary of GM, or we like to call ourselves like the stepchild of GM.
Being the stepchild means the 800 workers here and at the other three GMCH plants don't get what everyone else gets. All the production workers here make a lower wage than what workers at traditional GM plants can make. The UAW didn't always allow these tiered wages. For generations, the union fought so that workers who did the same job would make the same money. But in 2007, with GM facing bankruptcy, the union agreed to pay some workers less.
All right, you guys.
On the line, Holmes introduces me to Milton Cross and Lisa Sayre.
It didn't work. The two-tier doesn't work because it's divided us. It's lessened our quality through the whole General Motors.
I think we all want to be all one wage. I think that's what we all want.
Tiered wages created tiered realities for workers. And that's especially true here at this GMCH plant in Wyoming. And there's one other way this plant is different. Workers here make parts for engines and axles, but they don't just make parts for GM. They also make Toyota parts. And the Toyota workers, about 130 of the 800 workers here, they did not go out on strike. They kept working in the plant, literally crossing the picket line each day. Adam Underhill was one of them. He says the situation was a catch-22.
the Toyota product does help keep this plant open, yet I believe that true solidarity is 100%. You know, nobody crosses the picket line.
True solidarity. It's what the UAW says it's all about. But here, now, in 2019, everyone can see the cracks in that ideal. There are temp workers and seniority workers. There are low-tier wages and high-tier wages, production and skilled trades, Toyota parts and GM parts, GM components holdings, and traditional GM. It wasn't always like this. Willie Holmes knows because he saw it growing up.
I have six sisters and six brothers. So there's 13 of us, right? And my mom worked right here at this plant, right here. And I was thinking to myself, there is no way in the world that she could raise all of us kids without a job like this.
Years ago, GM had multiple plants in this area and thousands of workers. Now, it's just this one plant. Workers are supposed to be happy they have a job here at all. The union is trying to hold on.
But you think that story of your family, you think that's still possible for a GMCH worker out here?
It is, if they're treated right, if they're treated fairly and paid fairly. You can raise your family.
Have you seen any robots?
This is Diego. He's 5 years old. Yerlene Carranza is his mom. She's trying to get Diego, his brother, and his sister to eat their hot dogs one evening inside the union hall.
Okay, hey, calmaditos, okay? Coser, over there, now.
It's day 25. A food pantry has opened in the hall. Lunch and dinner are served every day by volunteers, mostly retirees from this local. Carranza stands by the wall with a baseball hat on and earbuds dangling from her neck. She's a single mom with three young kids, and for the past 2 weeks, she's been surviving on strike pay. That's $250 per week.
You can't be prepared for something like this because, one, you don't know how long it's going to go for, and two, you truly don't understand how you're affected until you're affected by it, you know? I can't even afford a babysitter right now.
Her rent bill, she says, is $1,600 a month, $600 more than she'll make with the strike pay. She says her sister helped cover it for last month. She's also called consumers to try to work out a deal on her utilities, and she has to worry about food.
It's literally rice and beans, and I'm not trying to be the sappy story, but it's rice and beans and like this type of stuff. You know, you go to places where they help you, where they're willing to help you. So it's bad. I'm sorry, but it's really bad.
She stares out across the union hall. Many of the workers here are hurting. They started this strike talking about GM's record profits. Now was the time for them to get their fair share. But it was costing them. On day 31, there's news. A statement comes out from the union. A tentative deal has been reached. The union releases a summary of the agreement. I go back to the union hall. Inside the big room, a couple retirees sit around, hearing the news secondhand from the offices at the front of the building.
Heard quite a few of the F-bombs coming out of there.
All the headlines outside the hall are focused on the signing bonus workers would get in the tentative deal. And it's a big one, $11,000 for seniority workers, $4,500 for temps. But inside UAW Local 167, everyone is focused on the section of the summary for GMCH. It says these workers will stay at a lower wage than the rest of GM. Their highest wage will be about $10 less per hour than the highest wage at the regular plants.
All we get is what they decide on, you know.
Anthony Bennett sits in a chair in a wood-paneled front office processing what he just read.
And it's nothing new. It's nothing new at all. We continuously get burnt in the contracts. We do.
UAW Local 167.
On day 36, yes. I catch up with Willie Holmes.
I'm not surprised about the contract that we got. I'm disappointed.
For the deal to be finalized, the UAW's rank and file will have to vote to approve it. Holmes knows how the members of Local 167 will vote. The question he has on day 36 of the strike is how the other 40-some thousand members will vote.
But a lot of members aren't happy. They are not happy. So, like I said, I think this vote is going to be really interesting. Just like this strike was historic, I believe this vote's going to be historic.
On day 39, the workers of UAW Local 167 vote. I found Cindy Holmes again, out on the picket line. She wouldn't tell me how she voted, but she wasn't happy.
I feel like we started out with a point to make, and I feel like it really didn't make any difference.
I talked to more than a dozen members of UAW Local 167 since the tentative deal was announced. Only one told me for sure that he was voting yes. Even Yerlene Carranza, with three kids to support on her own, who still doesn't know how she'll pay this month's rent, she wants the deal to fail.
I'm praying it doesn't pass. Obviously, we're all praying it doesn't pass.
Those prayers, it now seems, have not been answered. To Carranza, the GMCH workers got left out.
You know, the union's big thing is solidarity. Do you feel like there's solidarity? How do you feel about it?
Oh, gosh. Oh, that one's a tough question to answer.
Why?
Because, being honest, they forgot about us. They got something that benefited, that was a benefit to them, but not to us, though. So I don't think there was solidarity.
Out on the picket lines for 40 days, workers say yes, there was solidarity. And in the local union hall, Carranza says there was solidarity, but not in the overall deal. At UAW Local 167, 60% of members voted against the contract. Despite that, there's enough support at the other GM plants to pass it and end this historic strike. By Monday, 43 days after the strike started, the workers at UAW Local 167 could be back on the job. I'm Dustin Dwyer.
The Stateside crew wants to hear from you. What are the big stories we should check out? What issues are important to you but not getting any coverage? Tell us. Our email is stateside@michiganradio.org or find us on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio. We're also on Twitter @StatesideRadio and at michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. When you look at the night sky, what do you see? If you live in or near a city, not much, thanks to light pollution.
We can't see the stars. We can only see maybe 150 or so stars in the sky in Ann Arbor, when in fact we should be able to see tens of thousands of stars.
We'll be talking about the light's impact on humans and wildlife and what we can do about it. That's coming up on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. One of the big issues this deer hunting season is about the ban on baiting and feeding deer. Old rock star Ted Nugent testified before the legislature saying this ban would essentially be the end of family hunting in Michigan. But experts say the ban on baiting will slow the spread of chronic wasting disease among deer. Amy Trotter is the executive director of the Michigan United Conservation Clubs. That organization represents some 200 hunting, fishing, and other types of groups. First, tell us what baiting is. What's the purpose?
Baiting is placement of some kind of food, usually apples, carrots, sugar beets, corn, to lure in a deer, to entice them to a spot where a hunter is hunting. It is a tool to be used. It is a valid tool to be used. However, in the face of disease, that's where, from MUCC's perspective, we have a concern, because it is also a factor in transmitting disease, because as deer are coming in closer and closer, their nose to nose, their saliva, their it's all congregating right there. And with chronic wasting disease, that's a particular concern, because the prions from the disease actually will stay in the soil. So even after the bait is gone and the deer move away, that prion remains in the soil in that bait site where they've been replenishing that food over the course of a season.
So let's talk about chronic wasting disease itself. What does it do to the deer?
Chronic wasting disease is a fatal disease of deer. So once a deer obtains it, it will die from the disease. It's degenerates the brain, essentially, and affects the central nervous system of a deer. So much like Alzheimer's or dementia, they become listless. They, start to wander. They waste away. And that's why it's called chronic wasting disease. So they will die of the disease. And again, it is transmitted through a prion, which is not a vaccine, which is not a virus, which is not a bacteria. So there's no vaccine, there's no antibiotic or anything that can cure it at this time.
How big of a problem is it in Michigan?
In Michigan, we're really still on the beginning edge, but it is a significant concern. We've done a lot of testing here in Michigan. The first deer in the wild was found in 2015, and we found several hundred more since then. We know where these sites are, and the point is, in the baiting ban, is to not let those CWD zones grow. So we're really trying to prevent the spread and the transmission outside of those zones at this point, because once it becomes endemic in an area, because of the way the disease presents in the deer, they actually may live for another couple years and continue to shed and transmit the disease. And then because of how it holds in the soil, once an area has it, it's highly likely that it will not be eradicated from an endemic area, but you can prevent it.
With all of that, why is Ted Nugent so upset about a baiting ban?
Baiting is one of those factors that has grown more and more popular and socially acceptable over time. It was not a practice that was widely used even back in the 80s. Only about 30% of hunters actually baited back then. Now it's probably over 50% from a statewide perspective, and that's regionally even varied because the Upper Peninsula, about 80% of hunters bait. So it's definitely more common in the UP and the northern lower areas. And some people have grown up through the generations that they haven't known how to hunt in any other way except to utilize bait. So they really feel that we're attacking, you know, their way of hunting, their way of life, even in the outdoors. And that's really where Ted Nugent comes from. He's trying to stand up and be a voice for those hunters. But from our perspective, we believe in the science. We believe this is the right step to do. And we want to be able to help and to educate hunters on why this is a concern. And also, there are other tactics to use out in the field to still be a successful hunter without bait.
Michigan radio reporter Kayla Fawn today reported on a radical, unpopular, but effective way of eradicating chronic wasting disease, and that is completely killing off herds in areas where the disease crops up. That's been done elsewhere. What do you think of that controversial approach?
Well, there's areas in the state of Michigan, and I did hear Chad Stewart from the DNR say that it's probably not even feasible in certain areas of Michigan. There are actually too many deer that we would not be able to even accomplish that. But beyond that, we always believe, MUCC always believes, that hunters should be the first and primary tool for wildlife management. We pay for the privilege of being able to hunt these deer. We don't want to have to pay sharpshooters to take care of any issues. So we want to be a part of the solution when it comes to managing wildlife. However, MUCC has really tempered its opinion over years, and there are some cases where some sharpshooting should occur. Usually when it's out of season, we have a positive disease test, and we need to just find out in a very, very small circumference around that positive deer if there are any further positives, so we can do some quick surveillance on the ground. And again, this is typically used outside of the hunting season in a very new area for disease where it might be used. And there's always public safety as well. So sharpshooters are used to protect airline safety, from deer running across the runways and things like that. So that's been a pretty common practice. It's not popular, but it certainly is another tool that is necessary for public safety.
Amy Trotter is the executive director of the Michigan United Conservation Clubs. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We're going to take a moment to talk about a form of pollution which does not get as much attention, let alone regulation. light pollution. Some Michigan municipalities have passed ordinances aimed at reducing light pollution. Right now, the city of Ann Arbor is considering such an ordinance. Joining me now is Sally Uy. She's a professor at the University of Michigan's Department of Astronomy. She's an organizer of the Michigan Dark Skies Group and chair of the joint working group currently drafting a lighting ordinance for the city of Ann Arbor's consideration. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Lester.
All right. Why are you concerned about light pollution?
Well, there's several different reasons. In the first case, light pollution is, first of all, a waste of energy. Light is literally a form of energy, and right now we're trying to be conscious about saving energy and maintaining sustainability, and so wasting light is wasting energy. Second of all, there's also a problem with human health. It turns out that if you are exposed to a lot of unnecessary and unnatural light at night, then it affects your sleeping patterns, and that will be detrimental to your health. And thirdly, there's also a problem for the environment, because having an unnaturally bright environment at night is not a natural environment. And so this causes problems for wildlife and anything having to do with the ecosystem, basically.
I know former Governor Rick Snyder signed a resolution supporting the Detroit Audubon Society's Project Safe Passage Great Lakes, and it basically asks everyone to turn off their lights at 11 o'clock in the evening and keep them off until dawn during periods of bird migration in the spring and fall. Why isn't something like that enough?
Well, light pollution is something that takes place all year round, and so this is something that affects the environment all year round as well. Birds are only one of many species that are affected. I'm not a biologist, but we're only starting to uncover the tip of the iceberg, really, in terms of what the negative effects of light pollution are. There are many other species affected, fish, insects in particular, including pollinators. A lot of these are nocturnal pollinators that pollinate crops that are of economic importance. And so it's really a year-round problem.
You spend time studying the stars. How does light pollution affect our ability to see stars like the Milky Way and so on, for instance, in Ann Arbor?
Well, the Milky Way isn't visible in Ann Arbor. And one of the things that I find especially sad is when I have astronomy majors that I'm teaching, I do teach a course where I take astronomy students out to Kitt Peak in Arizona for a month, and it turns out that half of these students who are astronomy majors have never seen the Milky Way. So that's incredibly sad, and it's a statement about how connected we are to the universe and that we are more and more becoming more disconnected from the universe. We can't see the stars. We can only see maybe 150 or so stars in the sky in Ann Arbor, when in fact we should be able to see tens of thousands of stars. So this is a real problem. And in addition to that, one of the things that we in Michigan are especially privileged to have is the aurora borealis, which is the northern lights. That is something that also requires dark skies. A dark, moonless night is really the best for seeing the aurora borealis. And again, that is something that probably very few people, even in here in Ann Arbor, have seen, even though that is something that is seen regularly in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is not that far away.
So we've established that light pollution is a problem for many reasons. Let's get down to brass tacks. What can cities do to reduce light pollution?
Well, you mentioned that several municipalities are considering light pollution ordinances, and that is certainly one of the most effective things that we can start to do. This is important not just because we want to be able to have darker skies within the city itself, but even the surrounding communities are affected. So an area about 10 times larger than the area of the city itself that is producing the pollution is affected. And so having an ordinance would be especially useful.
I guess what I'm getting to is, what would the ordinance require? How do we reduce light pollution?
Right. So the ordinance that we are drafting for Ann Arbor would limit the amount of light trespass that's allowed at the property line. So we don't want to have any light that is leaking over the property line, basically. In addition to that, we want all the fixtures to be fully shielded so that light is not emitted above a horizontal plane. We also want to have a curfew so that lights are not on when they're not needed by the vast majority of people. There are also suggested limits to the brightnesses on facades and canopy lighting at gas stations and so forth, and parking lot lighting. And then finally, we also want to specify the color of the lights, that they not be too white and blue. So it turns out...
Well, there goes LED lights, at least the ones that are being used right now.
The ones that are being used right now, but technology is improving, and the LED companies are aware that blue lighting is not as beneficial as redder and yellower lighting. So we're trying to promote warm color temperatures that are yellowish or redder in color. Those are less impactful.
How much is light pollution reduction going to cost city, businesses, homeowners? I mean, it sounds like you're going to have a lot of add-ons to any exterior light.
Well, ultimately, it should be a savings because we are going to be saving energy, and therefore our energy bills should go down. And furthermore, in the ordinance, as the way it's written now, is that any existing lighting is still permitted to be the way that it is.
Oh, it's grandfathered in then.
That's right.
Will a light pollution ordinance, though, mean less street light for walking and for sidewalks? I mean, people feel really safe when it's really well lit.
Mm-hmm.
Are we talking about less of that?
Not necessarily. Again, light pollution is light that is not used and not needed. So if you are illuminating the sidewalk, then that is light that is being used. So anything where you feel that there is a need to have light, that does not correspond to pollution. Now, that said, you know, there is a factor regarding safety that apparently many studies have shown that there is no real correlation between crime and lighting. So people do feel a lot safer when there's higher levels of illumination, but there are no consensus among the people who have studied this over decades of studies that there is actually an enhancement in safety when lighting increases.
When Detroit put its new LED lights in a few years ago, and I was covering Detroit at the time, you could not convince the neighbors that that was not a bad thing because we were spacing out the lights farther, even though they were brighter. They really felt like they were going to be victims of the darkness.
Well, again, you know, communities need to decide what they want to do about this. In Ann Arbor, we are a very data-driven community, and so people can be presented with the studies that show that there is no real correlation between lighting and crime. But again, if people decide that they need to have lighting, then we will have lighting, and it won't be considered pollution. Another thing that people can do with the lighting is make sure, once again, that it is fully shielded and that light does not go up into the sky, that the street lights have the warm color temperature and so forth.
I read that Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Maine are the only states east of the Mississippi River where there are dark sky areas. Does that mean Michigan's doing pretty well already?
Well, we're in a position where I would say that we're in a very privileged position. We are in a position where we can actually protect the night sky resources that we have. And indeed, we have the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and some areas of northern Michigan that are still in a pristine state, one that corresponds to the actual natural environment. And that is one of the main reasons why Michigan is one of the best places in the world to see the northern lights.
How many cities are really taking ordinances like this one that you're introducing in Ann Arbor seriously?
Well, quite a few cities out west have ordinances, meaning west of the Rockies and out in California and so forth. Back here, back east, it's not as well known. We don't have as many large parks and public land areas that are still in their natural state. So it's not as well known, but there are a few municipalities, for example, Northampton, Massachusetts, and there are several communities in Pennsylvania. Duluth is also another community. So it is gaining more and more recognition.
So what would your vision for Michigan and the effort to reduce light pollution look like? Ultimately, what do you want to see?
Well, ultimately, we would hope that all cities in Michigan would have a lighting ordinance, and we would hope that all citizens become aware of wasting light. It's just like the energy crisis back in the 70s when people realized that they maybe should drive a little less, maybe turn down the heat a little bit, not use as much energy. or perhaps considering water conservation in other areas where we know that water is very expensive and very precious. You wouldn't leave the faucet running, so why would you leave the lights on, kind of thing. So awareness is really what this is all about. If people would be more aware and more cognizant that the lights that they're just turning on outside may not necessarily be serving the purpose that they intended, they could look a little bit more carefully and make sure their lights are shielded and really doing what they want them to do and not be on when they're not being used.
So what can I do at home? What should I be doing at home? Or if I have a small business?
Well, there are actually some very simple things that any person can do. Number one, light only what is needed. Number two, light no more than what is needed. Number three, light only when needed. And number four, light no bluer than needed.
You know, I've got Christmas light plans this year. It's going to be tough to deal with that, right? I mean...
Well, the ordinance allows for that. We recognize that people want their Christmas lights. And so we have, an exception for Christmas lights. Hopefully they won't be on all year round. But hopefully they might be used in some moderation, but we do want to have a festive season.
Sally Uy is working with the city of Ann Arbor on an ordinance to reduce light pollution. She's also a professor at the University of Michigan Department of Astronomy and an organizer with the Michigan Dark Skies Group in Ann Arbor. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Still to come, they say politics makes for strange bedfellows, and that's certainly true of a recent push to reform term limits. We'll discuss that with our Friday political commentators. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. For the fourth time, the legislators in Lansing are considering so-called energy freedom bills. The idea is to give utility customers greater leeway to install community solar or microgrids for a neighborhood. Andy Belaskowitz has been reporting on this. He's with the Energy News Network, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let's start with some definitions. What are microgrids and community solar?
So community solar are small-scale solar projects that utility customers who wouldn't otherwise be able to put solar panels on their own property, either because they're renters or it's just not within their budget, they can invest a share into one of these community solar projects that you can really get a collection of individuals and organizations to subscribe to a project like this. And the idea behind it is to really add additional solar resources to the grid.
So this will be like neighborhood solar?
Correct.
Okay. So what's a microgrid then?
The concept is thinking of it as an island. So if there was an outage and you had a hospital or something like that, something that has, you know, critical services, they can sort of separate themselves from the larger electric grid around them and generate their own power either on-site or nearby and basically shield them from potential outages from the grid at large.
So who is in favor of allowing this energy freedom and who is against it?
So at this point and over the years, utilities DTE Energy and Consumers Energy have been opposed to these bills in concept, largely because they have concerns about who's going to pay for this, right? So if a relatively small number of their customers want to invest in these types of projects, they are concerned that other customers who aren't participating are going to bear the cost for these.
In what way?
So if a utility basically is required to interconnect these projects to their grid and pay for that energy, and there's a lot of dispute about what utilities should be paying for this energy that's coming onto their system by third parties.
Right. In the past, they've been getting retail rates, right?
There's a range of sort of programs and tariffs that are in place that really all kind of have to do with what utilities pay for electricity they don't generate.
So this has nothing to do with the fact that this might be micro competition.
I think you can make that argument as well. There's the, I guess, maybe a more general or broader concern from utilities, or at least just skepticism when they start getting into this aspect about how they're going to deal with other parties putting electricity onto their system.
Now, as you wrote, this type of legislation has been introduced in past sessions of the Michigan legislature and never passed. Why do they think they can pass this time?
So there's a variety of factors at play here. And when I first started covering energy policy in Michigan 5 years ago, right about the time this was introduced for the first time, these were kind of new concepts, not just here in Michigan, but across the country. But supporters of these bills are coming back now and saying this is an economic development tool. This is a job creation tool. I think that's a big selling point, particularly among Republican lawmakers. Each of the years these proposals have been brought up, they've been what's called tie-barred together. So they were separate bills, but they were all together in one package. And so when you get into issues around microgrids, as we discussed earlier, around community solar projects and how those financing structures work, just the intricacies of each of those topics alone are complex enough. The thinking is to kind of divide these issues and look at them individually.
Are there other states in the Great Lakes region that have allowed community solar or these other shared renewable energy installations?
Yeah, so Minnesota actually is really a leader in the nation when it comes to community solar. It's mandated in their state law that utilities have to provide these types of projects to customers, and it's really just taken off in the past year or two in Minnesota. We're talking, you know, tens, hundreds of megawatts of power, which, you know, by comparison, in Michigan, there's only about, I want to say, around 100 or 200 megawatts of solar developed total. Illinois is getting on board with this as well. And Illinois has also done some more work in the microgrid space. Overall, though, you know, I think this leans toward more of the emerging technology, emerging issue side of things in the energy sector.
Andy Belaskowitz reports for Energy News Network. His report is titled Bipartisan Energy Freedom Bills Resurface in Michigan, One at a Time. Andy, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Lister.
Will Michigan change term limits? Legislative leadership has approached Voters Not Politicians, the group that successfully backed a ballot measure that will virtually end gerrymandering, to consider an effort to eliminate term limits or at least lengthen the amount of time someone can hold office. Joining me to talk about that are our Friday political commentators. T.J. Buchholz is president of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm. He worked for Governors Engler and Granholm and headed up communications for Lieutenant Governor John Cherry. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow for Public Sector Consultants. He's also a former Republican majority leader of the Michigan Senate. All right, T.J., you ask any random group of people about term limits and whether they're in favor of them, and they really like the idea of stopping career politicians and, as they say, throwing the rascals out. How do you think voters will respond to this possible initiative?
Well, unfortunately, term limits in terms of their popularity with Michigan citizens are still relatively high. People believe if you don't follow the legislature with any sort of regularity, that term limits sort of keep the bad guys at bay and make sure that there's a, you know, a fresh new influx of people in Michigan who, you know, are focused on real issues. But the fact of the matter is that I think we're learning, and we have learned, that term limits have not been successful in Michigan from a policy perspective.
Why do you say that?
Well, I think a couple things. One, the acrimony and the hue and cry that goes on in Lansing has only become more polarized and has not led to a system or an environment that lends itself to making bipartisan deals. And we saw this in the last budget. I mean, things are so polarized in Lansing that a Democratic governor creates a budget in one corner and Republican legislators create a budget in another corner with very little discussion, very little talking. That just didn't happen, you know, years ago when there weren't term limits because people realized it was, you know, more of a long-term position and that they had to work together with their colleagues.
Ken, 13 years of research out of Wayne State University shows that term limits did not accomplish the things that its backers predicted, you know, having these citizen legislators. Instead, it created a whole new set of problems. Should and can term limits be changed in Michigan?
Well, I want to, you know, I certainly want to give the two legislative leaders credit, along with the State Chamber of Commerce and the organization Voters Not Politicians. I want to give them credit for apparently having some serious discussions about it. But we're a long way from anything appearing on the ballot soon because there are so many issues that have to sort of be wrestled with. You know, what does it look like and who does it affect? For example, do you lengthen it for statewide offices along with the legislature? The timing of it, when you put something on the ballot, you know, what are the other elements that might go along with it? So, you know, give people credit for jump-starting the discussion, but we're a long way from something that voters are going to cast a vote on.
Now let's talk a little further about why you guys think they should be changed. I mean, the idea is, you know, we've had these fresh faces and nobody gets too comfortable, but at the same time, you lose all that institutional knowledge. You lose the fact that people are thinking long-term because they know they might still be in that same office in 10 years and they want to make sure that they don't have to deal with this problem again. Those plus, you know, the concept that lobbyists and bureaucrats are the only ones with institutional knowledge anymore. Are all those things sellable to the public? TJ?
Well, again, Ken is totally right. We have a long way to go to convince Michigan voters that term limits need to be modified. But I think that all the data shows us that governing has become increasingly difficult, and term limits is one of the reasons for that. Again, it's when you don't have to hang around to sort of reap the whirlwind where you are, you know, penned in by circumstance, when you create an environment that you have to live in, different decisions can be made. And, you know, again, we have very strict term limits here. And while we may not be able to completely eliminate them, we need modifications to those term limits here so we can actually have an environment in which individuals can make this more of a longer stop in their career, where they can develop relationships and understand the process. I mean, Ken was a very respected leader when he was in the legislature, and that's because term limits were not in effect. He worked across the aisle with people on so many issues. But today, you know, bipartisan agreement doesn't always happen. And it doesn't because people don't have to deal with the circumstances of the decisions they make.
Ken, that idea of institutional knowledge being handed off to bureaucrats and lobbyists, is that real?
Oh, yeah. And mostly it goes to the bureaucrats. Actually, you know, lobbyists under term limits, they have as tough a time as anybody because of the turnover. It's really the bureaucrats because they're not term limited, and I think the power has shifted to the executive branch. The reason I don't like term limits, there's a lot of them, but there's two impacts that I think are really bad. One is you don't have time to build any political capital to cast tough votes, and that goes against how they were sold. That the idea was that, well, you'll have these citizen politicians that don't worry about the political consequences. They could just do the right thing. Well, that doesn't happen. You don't have time to build up support in your district so that you can cast a tough vote now and then. The second thing that happens is it's increased political fundraising enormously because of the turnover of seats. People get elected to the state house. They immediately start fundraising for a state senate race. And it's never good to increase the need to raise money in politics.
I want to ask about one more thing that kind of raised some eyebrows. This idea of the Republican leadership working with voters, not politicians, is a bit novel. I mean, the Republicans are not happy with the voter-approved idea of an independent commission for redrawing the lines of districts. This kind of confirms that whole idea of politics makes strange bedfellows. TJ, what's going on here?
Well, I think that, you know, Ken said this in the beginning of the interview, you know, I think that people do have to be given some credit to try and jumpstart the process here. And again, voters, not politicians, I think a couple of years ago came out of nowhere and created a system of change in Michigan, which I think we'll start to see the benefits of in the next year or two. But term limits are an entirely different story. The numbers are not good in terms of people understanding the impact of term limits, how they can be negative to the governance process. And so, you know, I think that the chamber and I think Republican leadership have said for, you know, a few cycles now. Mike Shirky, the Senate Majority Leader now, I think has alluded to this, that we need to change this. And I don't think that sentiment comes from Senator Shirky wanting to stay in office forever. I think he understands that it's the landscape in Lansing is increasingly difficult and we need to make some changes. But yeah, you see this a lot where you have different people with perhaps different perspectives sort of banding together and that's admirable, but we're going to need many more people in the bandwagon before we be able to effect some change.
Yeah, we've heard from more than one Speaker of the House, former Speakers of the House, who've said, there's no way I should have had that position. I didn't know enough to have that position. Ken, what do you think of this idea of voters, not politicians, working with the Republican leadership?
It's going to be an uphill climb to convince the public to make changes to term limits. And so to do that, you are going to need a powerful coalition spanning the political spectrum. And voters, not politicians, state chamber of commerce, Republicans and Democrats sort of would provide the foundation for that kind of powerful coalition. But as we've already pointed out, it's going to be an uphill climb.
Ken Sikkema is Senior Policy Fellow for Public Sector Consultants. He's also a former Republican Majority Leader of the Michigan Senate. T.J. Buchholz is President of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm. He worked for Governors Engler and Granholm and headed up communications for Lieutenant Governor John Cherry. Gentlemen, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks, Lester.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. I'm Lester Graham, and this is another episode of Cheers to Michigan. I see a bottle of rye. I can't think that this is going to go badly.
We do both like rye. So today I'm making the long arm of the law. So this is a recipe that I found a bunch of years ago when I was researching recipes for one of my Made in Michigan classes. And I found the description of this on the Detroit City Distillery website. I didn't have any proportions, so I just kind of winged it. I have no idea if this tastes like what it tasted like when they made it, but I like it and it's become a fall go-to drink for me.
And you're using their rye too.
Of course. It has 1.5 ounces of the Detroit City Distillery rye, and then it's got 3/4 ounce of lemon juice, because it is a sour. It's got 1/2 ounce of cinnamon syrup, which is acting as a sweetener for the drink and bringing some of those fall flavors. And then the thing that makes it really different is it has a spoonful, bar spoon, teaspoon of fig preserves.
Well, that sounds nice, and I want to try it because it looks delicious, too. You got a nice little cinnamon stick in there, too. Very fancy. It's very well balanced. It's a little sweet for my taste.
I don't think it's sweet at all. I think it's really nicely balanced. Using preserves and jams and cocktails can definitely change the mouthfeel of them. They add some body to it, which might be a little bit of what you're picking up.
I also think the cinnamon makes me think of sweet.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. Because I did use that jam in there and because figs have little seeds in them, I did double strain this drink. So that meant that after I shook it, I strained it with my regular Hawthorne strainer and then I used like a tea strainer or a fine mesh strainer to strain it out into the glass so that we didn't get those little floaty bits. It's just a nicer presentation, but if you like floaty bits in your drink, you obviously don't have to do that.
I'd take this drink either way, I think. So have you tested this out on anybody else?
I use it a lot in my private events, and one of the things I really like about it is there are a lot of people who don't like whiskey, or at least think they don't like whiskey, and this is one of those cocktails that even somebody who comes in thinking they don't like whiskey actually tends to like this drink, so it's a good gateway.
That's the long arm of the law. Cheers.
Cheers.
Next week on Stateside, we talk to Rachel Den Hollander. She was one of the strongest voices for survivors during the Larry Nassar scandal. She discusses her role as a leader, a daughter, and a mother in her new memoir, What is a Girl Worth? Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, Ted Davis, Adam Reyes, and Catherine Newhan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.